there. I'm Long John. My guest is George Adamski. Fairly a very unusual man, a man that claims that he's been in flying saucers and what have you. First, I'd like to show you, Doug, a copy of a newspaper that will point out to all of us that Mr. Adamski was a guest of the Queen of the Netherlands, Juliana. Of course, you may not be able to read this, but I have another newspaper over here, a clipping. I think this is from one of the American newspapers. And you possibly see this on your screen at home in just a matter of a moment. Mr. Adamski certainly is a very unusual man, and I think that he has a very unusual story. George, the very first thing I want to talk about, or first of all I'd like to say, you have, without a doubt, some very fantastic stories, such as seeing flying saucers, meeting space people, riding in spaceships, and all the like. But one thing that really amazes me, why did the Queen of the Netherlands want to have you at the palace? What was the reason for this meeting, or are you the one that arranged it?
No, I haven't arranged it, John. It was a letter that came in while I was in Brisbane asking for, or requesting, 25 minutes, which turned out to be 2 hours exactly after I got there, and it was sent to one of the group leaders that was sponsoring my program in Brisbane. And you can read that if you wish.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to read the entire letter here, but the one paragraph may be of interest. The first paragraph. Today, we had a telephone call from our Queen's private secretary asking us if we could arrange a private audience with George Adamski at the palace to meet the Queen. I presume that you feel that this establishes the fact that the Queen invited you and that you did not promote the whole thing, right?
That's correct. I had no slightest idea that on that worst trip I would meet any dignitary just like I had met. I had no idea whatever. Nothing was brought out before that. They all came, as you might say, suddenly, out of nowhere.
What was the reason for the trip around the world?
Well, the reason for the trip around the world is a lot of people are interested, far more than we realize, and was to bring the information I had to the public in general, not in these organized groups, because organized groups were on the average from 20 to 40 in the group, what they call flying saucer groups, and so forth, that organized all over the world in all nations. But my lectures, they took place in various towns and larger cities. Finally, it turned out that the public was interested to such an extent that from 300 to 1,800 people would be turned away every night. And we did lecture every night. George, do you think that these people that attended your lectures, that they really believe in flying saucers?
Well, and not all of them, I wouldn't say. Some actually was curious, some did believe,
but I was kind of slashed the team in half. Supposing 2,000 people attended, I would say 1,000 at least were serious mentally.
Serious mentally?
Yeah, mentally, that is accepted mentally.
I see.
I thought for a moment that you were implying that possibly some of these people were not all there.
Well, I don't know.
Well, I couldn't say, you know, whether they were or not, but I found that men like head of the governments and officials of various types had a lot of it got well, just like the governments, whichever country I would be lecturing in. You take councilmen, like for instance, Wellington in New Zealand, it was a councilman of the federal government, as we'd call it in our country, that organized this lecture. People like that had been present. Even in Rome, I had various priests and military agitators and military men present in the lecture, and all the lectures were the same way.
The fact that priests attended your
luxury. Would you say that this means that they believe in flying saucers or in the possibility of space people landing here on this planet?
I wouldn't say that they believe or disbelieve. At least they were interested, and I might say this, that in Rome especially, after the lecture, two priests come up to me and he said, in these words, and he said, thank you, brother, for the kind information you have given to us.
Were you with the Queen of the Netherlands, too?
Well, I'm supposed to have had, according to that, a request to us for 45 minutes,
according to
that. And instead, it was almost 2 hours, because it was 5 minutes to one, when the Queen finally spoke up and she said, you're going to be late to your lecture. I already was late 20 minutes late. George, I've made a couple of notes after reading your book. And I would like to question you about some of these things. In your book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, which you wrote with Desmond Leslie, you state that your first flying saucer sighting was on October 9th, 1946, at Palomar Gardens, California. Can you tell me something about that?
Yes.
That was the time, you know, if you remember, go back there, when there was a heavy meteoric shower, and the moon was coming out pretty strong then too. So first that evening before the moon came up, the meteoric shower took place, which was quite early, around 6 o'clock or so. And we were told, as I was an amateur astronomer having two telescopes, we were requested to count the meteorites that we could count. How many of them were falling?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it got so when the moon finally wasn't pretty high, you couldn't see some of the smaller ones that you did before. So it got lesser and lesser, and then we finally quit. As we about to quit counting, you know, the number of people, not only myself, and we're over the mountains, which is known to be Rodriguez Mountain, Volcan Mountain, towards San Diego from Panama, looking for San Diego. A big dirigible type of ship came along. Now, at that time, I didn't believe in ships, you know. A big dirigible type, but had no basket like dirigibles.
What did you think the mix was?
I thought it was probably some development come out of the World War No. 2, but we knew heard nothing about a dirigible without a basket.
Something or something.
That's right. Yes, because they did announce that there would be a group of B-29s in the sky also counting meteorites and observing them that they were falling. In the same book, a few pages later, you claim, George Adamski, that 6 military officers stated that this spaceship was, now to quote your book, not of this world. Who were these military officers? Were they American, and why did you name them in the book?
I don't know
their names right now. But they were from Arizona base.
In the way, in uniform?
Yes. They was in the restaurant eating. And the restaurant, by the way, was not mine. I was just living on the premises, belonged to Mrs. Wells.
Do you own the restaurant?
No. I never did. I never owned a business in my life. That's why I'm running a business is concerned, running one. But I lived on the premises, right, and I did. And, of course, people coming down from the big observatory, and I had the telescopes up there, and we show them through my telescopes what they couldn't see at the big observatory. And they finally would ask about these flying saucers. They just recently been appearing on the scene. So there were some people discussing this question with me. When these officers at the table were listening, and I said it was fantastic. And one of the officers spoke up and he says, no, it's fantastic as it seemed to be. If you're near one of them, like I've been within 2 feet, you'd realize how realistic they are.
Who were these majors, colonels?
Well, there was a captain in it. I remember, I don't know of any major, but there was a captain, few lieutenants, and so forth, all of the Air Force at that time.
Were they sent to Palomar Gardens?
No, they weren't.
They weren't.
That's just review. No, not at all. They went up to the top, and they were coming up from the top, which we call the top, where the observatory is, to the observatory, and stopped on the way down for a little sandwich.
Of a spaceship or a flying saucer, according to Mr. Adamski, he made the original original photograph. This is a blow-up of it. And back, let me get the date correct here, on a Thursday, the 20th day of November in the year of 1952, a person landed someplace near Palomar Gardens in California, and the person got out of this craft, and our guest, Mr. Adamski, had the opportunity of interviewing the person. Now, it's a fantastic story, George. You claim that you spoke with a person from Venus, and according to your book, you spoke with him for almost an hour. Do you want to begin at the beginning and tell
us? Well, in the first place, of course, it's fantastic. Anything new is fantastic in the beginning. But the fact remains that I had spoken to the man on November the 20th of 1952 in the presence. They weren't exactly right close by, but they were watching me all the time, 600 witnesses.
How close by?
Well, about, the longest distance I was here would be half a mile.
About a half a mile away.
Yeah.
And it is not the person I charge for anybody to actually witness something.
Well, it's sufficient enough that Mrs. Wells, who was the owner of Palomar Gardens, because she saw it, a pretty good artist, had sketched the man later, and I had to buy him a letter. I had to give her the color and so forth that she could put in what it was, to kind of a suit and so forth. But getting back to the November 20th, these people, which were from Prescott, Arizona, asked me next time I go out in the desert with a hope of getting a picture, and that's all I was going out there for, which was quite a ways from Palomar Gardens or Palomar Mountain, quite a ways. I would say around 180 miles, I believe, or from there, somewhere in there, between 150 and 180 miles. I don't know exactly. But it was in Desert Center, where it was. It was very near to Colorado River, not too far from there, about 40 miles inside. And we come up on this highway, which is known as the Parker Highway, going to Parker Dam, Arizona, where the Indian Reservation is. And we stopped on a hump of it, went on a hump where it goes uphill and then downhill again. We saw our own plane go by on routine flight.
When you say our own plane, you're referring to an American plane?
An American plane, yes. All of us saw that together. And then all of a sudden, there's another one appeared, which we called in, recently been called, Mothership. Not the one you showed us. That's a scout, what they call a scout.
The Mothership has nothing to do with the American Air Force.
No, no.
This is from another planet.
From another planet. At the time, we didn't know it was from another planet. But we looked at it closely, and two binoculars, and had no antennas using any kind, like a wing or anything else. And on the surface of it, it showed a big orange circle. What that meant, I don't know to this day. But it had a big orange circle painted right on the surface of it. So we realized then this was out of this world, because nobody in this world had anything about type. So I went down
to knowledge.
Yeah, to my knowledge. And then we went down from this top of the hill, down where I could set up my telescope, my 6-inch. I always took it with me, because there had been reports of them landing out the desert, and I was in hopes of at least getting a decent picture of a spacecraft, if not of the people. So we went down and set up the telescope. I had 8 plates, or cut film, loaded in the plates, and after I set it up, this thing, I looked up, I want to take a picture of the mothership. That's all I know at the time. While doing this, this other scout ship that you showed by the picture here must have come out, but when, I don't know. But he came out and came in just about where we were and started circling around. Then I want to get that picture, which I did. I exposed it to him as fast as I knew how. I didn't know how long he was going to stay, when he was going to go, or anything like that. So I didn't even have too good a focus on it at the time. And I couldn't have got as good a picture as I did had it not been for the telescope. The telescope lent itself like a big telescopic lens. So that's how I've been able to get it as well as I did.
Did you shoot the picture through the telescope?
Oh, yes.
Did
I had an attachment, but you put the camera right over the eyepiece. And while I'm speaking of this, some might be listening to this. You take the eyepiece out. The lens out of the camera, and leave the eyepiece in there, and that acts as the lens for the camera. See, otherwise you mess it up. So I had it all fixed, and you put it in there, and all I have to do is put the face in, expose them, and take it out. And to expose a picture like that, you can't push on it, because the telescope, you might move the telescope, and you move the telescope slightly, and you clean off the target. So you've got to use the whole system in the bulb to squeeze it, you know, so you don't move the telescope.
Now, that's a plate-type camera, like a Graflex.
That's right. It was an old Graflex at that. They were good for the purpose of we go along with the telescope
focused on the ground glass.
That's right. That's right. The focus on the ground glass, and when I saw it, it was near focus, and I put it over, and this, he said, didn't have too much of a time to really get a shot picking focus, because the fellow was moving all around. So after he passed over the mountaintop, out of sight again. In the meantime, the B-52 up in the sky, also our own ship, see? And the mothership went further out there. You can hardly see it when I looked up. And so I thought that was it. So I called to the group and asked them to come up to help me dismantle my telescope and put it back in the car. Well, just then, as I looked up, I saw a man out there waiting quite a distance from me. I was about a quarter of a mile or so distance waving to me. Well, the way he was dressed, and out of that, they didn't pay much attention to him, because people in the desert go out prospecting and so forth, let their hair grow, there's no barber out there, and they have sort of a jumper suit and so forth, so I thought maybe this fellow needed help. Well, he waved to me, spotted me there, so I walked up. In the meantime, the folks walked up a little ways too from where they were to help me with this new telescope. Well, when I got closer to him, I was cautious, but when I got closer to him, the cautiousness kind of left me.
Why?
I don't know, there was a feeling about the man, but he was very friendly. That's the feeling I got from him.
Has this ever happened to you before?
No, not like that. Not that quickly, just like somebody just removed the wall from between the two people, see? That's why not how quick it happened. Well, then I realized that this man was different than anybody I would have met out in the desert prospecting, since he had a suit on, like a close to appeared to me like a one-piece suit, but on later time, that I met him several times after that, I noticed that the belt covered up the unit there where the two parts of the clothes met. This belt about between 6 to 8 inches width. And so, his hair was hanging down, kind of a blondish hair, over his shoulders. And he was smooth in his face, like he never needed any shaving, or anything like that. So he puts on his smile and puts out his hand. Well, I looked to where my grip. Well, he refused that. And then I looked at him, and he went to work and put out his hand again. And I then followed his hand. He had it this way with the palm out, you know, this way straight. And I put my hand also with a palm to palm like this touch. See? And then he smiled. Then I tried to talk to him, and I got the impression that he didn't understand me. George, unfortunately, we don't have an awful lot of time. How did you speak with this Venetian? Did he understand English? He did later, I found out. At that time, I didn't know nothing about that he did.